and thank you for joining us again on Three Questions. This is Paul Saunders, president of the Center for the National Interest. I'm really thrilled to have with me today Dr. Ashley Finan, who is stepping down from a leadership role as Chief Science Officer for the National and Homeland Security Directorate at the Idaho National Laboratory. That's a real mouthful, Ashley, and previously had been the director of the Nuclear Reactor Innovation Center at the Idaho National Laboratory, a PhD in nuclear engineering from MIT, and in the process of becoming a fellow at the Columbia Center on Global Energy Policy. So, Ashley, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to be here.
So for those who have been following the podcast so far, I call it Three Questions. I ask three questions, although sometimes the questions get a little bit complicated because actually I have way more than three questions. So I need to pack, you know, a lot into each one. But maybe for the first question here, Ashley, you've done a lot of work on nuclear innovation, and there's so much happening in the nuclear energy technology world now. For people who aren't working on nuclear energy every day, and especially, you know, for people sort of outside of research institutes or outside the Washington Beltway, you know, where some of us get paid to pay attention to things like this, what do you think is kind of most important for people to know about nuclear innovation, the new reactor designs, and when are we going to start seeing some of this, you know, next door or maybe in the next county or state over?
So this country, well, I think it's important for people to know that the United States has invested decades in innovating and in pursuing commercialization of nuclear energy technologies that better address market needs and society's expectations. So those technologies use passive and inherent safety strategies for increased resilience. They have a lower waste profile and the potential for fuel recycling. They're designed to use increased manufacturing and modularity and even have more of the work done in factories instead of on site. Some have smaller, more flexible units, even moving to microreactors that can power remote locations and military power needs. Most importantly, advanced nuclear holds the promise of being economically competitive if we build projects continuously and at an industrial scale beyond these first-of-a-kind reactors that are underway now. All of the new designs are based on innovations that were tested or used in the past, but they've been improved by today's startup companies and established industry partners with the benefit of modern technology, like modern computers, for example, as a simple example, and with a really strong orientation towards what the market demands. They range from incremental improvements, but important ones, on the light water reactor fleet that we operate today. And that includes the Westinghouse AP1000, the NuScale power projects, the GE BWRX-300, Holtec SMR, and others, to more disruptive changes that use different fuel forms, new coolants, and can address new applications like process heat, as well as microreactors and the potential for improved performance in a variety of ways and better economics. So how soon will we see them? You know, at a high level, some are operating today, some we'll see before 2030, and I think we'll see many between 2030 and 2035. And I'll just dial down into that a little bit. So first, we have two AP1000s operating in Georgia, and those are advanced light water reactors that implement some of those key incremental but important innovations compared with the existing fleet. There are some advanced reactors operating in China, including the AP1000, but also high-temperature gas-cooled reactors, which are one of those more disruptive innovations and could provide process heat and operate at high temperature. In the United States, there are companies with projects underway now, many with some government support, either in cost sharing or fuel supply, that are aiming at startup between 2026 and 2028. I think there's a strong chance we'll see some of those in operation by 2030, with a real surge in startups between 2030 and 2035. Just across the border, Ontario Power Generation is targeting startup of GE's BWRX-300 by 2029. The Department of Defense Strategic Capabilities Office Pele project is a microreactor scheduled to complete before 2030, as well as projects with Kairos, Oklo, Alo Atomics, and several others that are planning to test reactors at INL, including Westinghouse, Radiant, and others. And then between 2030 and 2035, projects that are projected to come online include the X-Energy and Dow partnership in Texas, the TerraPower and Natrium project in Wyoming, and then more BWRX-300s from GE in Ontario, as well as some at the Tennessee Valley Authority at the Clinch River site in Tennessee. So that's what we have, you know, on the docket today already. Trump's executive orders call for even faster demonstration than what was planned, particularly at DOE and DOED sites. With a concerted and coordinated effort, I think that's possible. It would represent an acceleration of what we have planned for today.
Wow, that really sounds like a lot. That's pretty exciting. President Trump has really gotten very much behind nuclear energy. Just very recently here issued 4 executive orders that, you know, I think many people actually consider to be quite significant. I'm wondering how you evaluate those executive orders, how you think they may contribute to all of this, where you think there may be any limitations or things that are missing. How important will the executive orders be?
So the 4 executive orders cover an enormous breadth, really from fuel supply to fuel recycling and everything in between, including rapid deployment on DOE and DOD sites and elsewhere, regulatory reform, workforce development, and supports for exporting U.S. nuclear technology. So they're very comprehensive. I think that implementation will be key to success, especially in 2 areas, namely regulation and funding. In regulation, there are great ideas for regulatory reform in the EOs, including streamlining environmental reviews and continuing to implement reforms that were in the Bipartisan Advance Act. But implementation will really be pivotal here. There's the potential for that to go well and be supportive of an independent and effective NRC that is structured to regulate a surge of nuclear projects. And then there's the potential for it to go poorly and for implementation to result in confusion due to many regulatory rewrites, delay, understaffing, and potentially erosion of the independence or the appearance of independence of the NRC, both of which are crucial. So clearly what we need is the former, not the latter, and implementation will be important there. In terms of funding and in terms of what I see as gaps, I'd like to see a 2035 target for operation of new nuclear, of maybe say 20 gigawatts or more of US origin nuclear projects to be completed by 2035 so that we have a target between 2030 and 2050. 20 years is a long gap to not have a milepost. And then there are major investments that will be required to support this kind of work, moving from first of a kind to deployment at scale. And the executive orders aren't the place that would really appear, but I think it will be needed. So rather than necessarily a gap, what we don't have yet is congressional action that builds upon the vision laid out in the EOs, makes adjustments if they're needed, and provides support through tax credits, loan guarantees, perhaps a milestone-based payment approach for some of the projects that are called for in the next several years, and providing continued and increased support for U.S. nuclear exports.
The third question, and this, of course, is the last one, and people who listen to me even for a little bit know that I'm kind of really interested in the geopolitics of all of this, the geopolitics, generally geopolitics of energy and specifically, you know, the nuclear piece of that. And a big part of that is technology and U.S. technology leadership. Part of it is sort of economic trade investment. Some of it is, you know, strategic and diplomatic relations with other governments that maybe are partners in executing these kinds of things. We also have rivals and maybe even adversaries that we're competing against. So I'm wondering, you know, as you look at the global landscape and what's happening in nuclear around the world. How do you see the United States fitting into that? How do you see our sort of nuclear innovation and domestic deployment and, you know, hopefully exports sort of fitting in? Are we sort of poised really to sort of take back a leadership role that we had in the past? Are there things maybe that we still need to do? I'm sorry, this is like 10 questions in one question, but I'm just very interested how you see the global piece of it and America's role.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a pivotal question. Thank you, Paul. In my view, a U.S. leadership role in nuclear energy is both non-negotiable and presently absent. And that's extremely troubling when we consider the importance of U.S. influence on global safety, security, and nonproliferation norms, as well as the global security risks associated with China and Russia building nuclear energy around the world as part of their strategy for geopolitical dominance. Looking back, between 1956 and 1980, the United States was responsible for 50% of global reactor builds, and Russia was responsible for 10%. If we look at 1980 to 2010, the US was responsible for 5%, Russia for nearly 20%, and China for nearly 15%. And then today, of the 60 reactors currently under construction worldwide, 80% are of Russian or Chinese origin, and none are US origin. So we're in a really deeply troubling situation. The US has ceded its leadership role and must regain it. We are seeing some hopeful signs. I mean, the executive orders have a focus on this. Congress has had a focus on this need. And we have vendors around the world working with other countries to move towards construction. So Westinghouse and Bechtel have an agreement with Poland or the Polish utility to potentially build AP1000s there. And there are ongoing conversations and cooperation, primarily in Eastern Europe, but also elsewhere with US firms. In Eastern Europe, those countries have experienced the weaponization of energy, and they're looking for trustworthy partners. And so if the U.S. can show up and deliver on deployment at scale and exports, then I think we have the potential to retake that global lead, potentially starting with customers in Eastern Europe, but also across the world. I think that most countries are also looking for a trustworthy partner that can deliver, has the best technology, which the U.S. certainly can provide. We just need to get steel in the ground. So in that future where the U.S. retakes that global lead, I think there's a lot of room for other allied countries to export nuclear technology and to be part of those projects, including Canada, France, the U.K., potentially South Korea, Japan, and others. And supply chain cooperation around the world is going to be really important here. But at this point in time, with the global dominance of China and Russia, I think that U.S. leadership is essential to turning the tide on who leads in nuclear energy exports. And in my view, the importance of this change for global security cannot be overstated. Our focus today is on nuclear energy, but this significance applies across many critical technologies, including other energy supply chains, critical minerals, chips, data centers, AI. So we really need to move out as a country deliberately and urgently to achieve and maintain US leadership in these areas.
Thank you very much for that, Dr. Ashley Finan. I certainly couldn't agree more with the last sentiment you expressed there. Thank you for joining us so much. I really appreciate it on the Three Questions podcast. Again, this is Paul Saunders at the Center for the National Interest talking to Dr. Ashley Finan of the Columbia Center on Global Energy Policy.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's been great speaking with you.